it's time to take a listen to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you by Island Design every Saturday morning from 10 till 12. Last Saturday, Shireen caught up with Dr. Stuart Rubin talking about cell phone towers, Paul Harrop, conductor of the Auckland Youth Symphony Orchestra, Harriet Crampton from Sister Shout, and her very own Martini, who was talking about a sustainable fishing campaign. But first, Waiheke scientist Sarah Silverstar, who's collecting dead penguins.
Well, we've now got Sarah Silverman, who's come in to talk to us a little bit about what's been happening at the in the water this week. So, Sarah, what do you know about that?
Hi there. Well, not a great deal. I am attempting to, you know, gather some evidence to find out. I'm doing a master's in marine ecology next year at Massey University. So what I'm hoping to do, I've already got two penguins in my freezer, and I'm hoping to sort of put the word out. So any people on the island who find any dead penguins or even fish, penguins are preferable. If they could contact me and let me know, and I can sort of store them up. And failing, you know, I'm just sort of hoping to contribute to the research that's being done on the problem.
So what is the problem? Can you tell us a bit about that? Because there might be some people who don't know. I mean, as far as I know, Takapuna Beach was closed. The vet advised that some dogs had died on Takapuna Beach and that fish were coming up dead. And a few hours later that there was an algal bloom in the water.
Yeah, algal blooms do have that effect. They have, you know, they do, you know, the dogs were convulsing and so on, and that is characteristic of algal blooms. I feel that overall the indicators are that the environment is unhealthy, and this is another sign. You know, viruses sometimes crop up and affect marine life as well, and so viruses and algal blooms arise because there's an imbalance in the system.
Right, okay. And so why penguins? Why do you particularly want penguins?
Well, I feel that they'll be easier to examine than fish, because fish decompose a bit more readily, and they seem to be, it sounds to me from what they were saying about dead fish washing up on the North Shore, that the fish are sort of dying out at sea and then being washed in by the tide. So also what I'm keen to do is investigate plastics, the role of plastic pollution in the environment as well. So the penguins will be quite good, you know, when we do the dissections and so on, to find out if there's any plastic particles within them as well.
Right, okay. And so what are you going to do to the penguins?
Well, I'll take them to the lab, defrost them, and then we'll flush out the digestive system to get plastic particles, but they'll also want to take tissue samples and hopefully test those. I'd quite like to test for, you know, other chemicals as well, any sort of chemicals that might be present, but I don't know, at this stage, I don't know how complicated that's going to be. So, yeah.
So do you have a background in marine biology?
Yeah, I've done a science degree, and so that's quite broad. You sort of do quite a broad range of subjects within that, and I have done ecology, marine science, environmental science, geography, all that sort of stuff. And I'm wanting to branch out into specifically marine pollution, so that's my interest. And I'm quite keen to get out on a boat, if anyone's willing to take me for a wee ride in the next day or so, or next week, out into the harbour and see if we can collect some specimens as well. That would be really awesome.
And you were quite keen to maybe go out to Rangitoto if anyone is going that way?
Yes, I don't want to sort of broadcast that too much, and I believe they're actually preventing people to going near or on the island. Yeah, so that's, but yeah, in the vicinity of, if anyone's willing, that would be great.
Okay, lovely. So that's Sarah Silverman, and how can people contact you?
Yeah, it's Sarah Silverstar, and my number is 4476. And please, if I'm not there, just leave a message. I've got an answer phone there, so that'd be wonderful if anyone's... also, if people are out fishing in the next week or so and they see any penguins, if you want to collect them, that's great. Otherwise, just if you could just make a record of what you see, like two dead penguins and the rough location, that would be really fantastic if you could let me know. And I also have a website, and it's oceanaware.info. And you can go on there and send me an email, you know, log on and record any sightings that you might have as well. That'd be lovely.
Lovely. So you've been listening to Sarah Silverstar talking about what's been going on in the Gulf with all the pollution this week. Thanks very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
And now I've got Stuart Rubin with us, and he's been working quite hard on the cell phone tower issue. Hi, Stuart.
Good morning, Shirin.
So tell us, what's been happening with that?
Well, I don't know when you actually interviewed Andrew Crawford, but to bring you up to date, in October of 2008, Trevor Mallard, who is the Minister of Telecommunications, signed a new regulation called the National Emissions Standard. And what that has done is allowed the erection of cell phone transmitter stations as a permissible activity. That means that the telecommunication companies, we've got three now, Telecom, Vodafone and now 2degrees, can erect these without council necessarily being involved in the approval process on power poles. And if you go to the city, you'll see them all over the place. There's a very prominent one outside Trinity Cathedral in Parnell. So by making them a permitted activity, it's to some extent kneecapped the local authorities from being able to review and have any input into the decision where the telecommunication companies want to erect these. And they've got some ghastly plans. Some of these are being erected outside schools, outside kindergartens, over in Botany Downs, Howick and Cockle Bay. And this is a cause for grave concern, because an increasing number of us are concerned about potential adverse health effects of long-term exposure to radio frequency electromagnetic radiation. And I say that based on the fact that it's now acknowledged widely by such eminent scientists as Sir William Stewart, who is the chief scientist of the United Kingdom Health Protection Agency, who says that, yes, there is no doubt that there are biological effects of radio frequency electromagnetic radiation. And these biological effects, of course, are demonstrated in laboratory animals and have included such things as damage to the DNA, which makes up our genes, damage to the DNA in brain cells, testicular tissue in rats, and various other parts of the body. Now, the scientists that advise the Ministry of Health do not accept that this automatically leads to potential adverse effects, health effects in intact human beings.
That seems quite incredible, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
And you've spoken about this at a forum recently.
Yes, I was an invited speaker at Monaco City Council, and they had a public forum. There was also a public meeting 2 or 3 days later. But sadly, the bureaucracy of the city councils and central government seem to have got a closed mind to these things, and basically they're accepting the scientific input from the National Radiation Laboratory that the only science that will be accepted is a definite, absolutely definite evidence of adverse human health risks. Now, I put it to you that on June the 5th of this year, in the Queen's Bench High Court Division in London, the judges accepted the Atomic Veterans' submission that they were damaged in the experiments that were conducted on the armed forces in the Pacific in the 1950s, I mean, long before your time. But I, as a kid, grew up with these mushroom things going off at Bikini Atoll and et cetera, et cetera. And what the Brits and the Americans did was they got servicemen to sort of stand and watch these things. Now, the High Court there in London has supported their contest that they should be able to sue the Ministry of Defence for biological damage that's produced cancers in them and in their kids. And the evidence that really swung the High Court justices was evidence that was produced by a New Zealand scientist called Al Rowlands from Massey University, and it was he that demonstrated DNA damage in these atomic veterans. So what I'm saying is the same thing applies to, potentially applies to electromagnetic radiation.
So why is it that we're not seeing any kind of progress in this issue or any kind of recognition that there might be adverse effects and that maybe we should be monitoring more closely how people use cell phones, where cell phone towers are erected, et cetera, et cetera?
Big business. Telecommunication companies are a vast multinational conglomerate. For example, in the United Kingdom in the early 2000s, the UK government received something like £24.6 billion in issuing licences to telecommunication companies, and they receive an annual rental of somewhere like £10 billion. Now, you know you've got to buy a commercial frequency to run this radio station, and that's going to the local authority, but national governments are selling off the frequencies. And so it's a huge income resource for governments, and they are very reluctant to sacrifice that sort of income.
So how is the protest organised now? Because I can see that in lots of different parts of the country, particularly down in Nelson and I think in Papakura as well, Waiheke, there are pockets of people who are standing up and protesting and saying, look, we need to investigate this further. We don't want it near our schools.
That's
we don't
right.
want it in our communities. We don't want cell phone towers near our houses.
What's
been happening with that lately?
The people in Nelson actually formed an incorporated society last year called Ban the Cell Phone. And what we're trying to do at the moment is either join their incorporated society or form our own with the Auckland groups, because that leaves us the opportunity to challenge approvals of these new projects to the Environment Court. And whilst that could be expensive, if you're an incorporated society, apparently you can get legal aid, which would pay for the services of a decent environmental lawyer like Sue Gray from Nelson would do the work. Now, if the judgment goes against you, you don't have to pay damages because you can just disincorporate, you can just dissolve the society and start again with a new name. So there are sort of subtle ways that we can, you know, pursue this avenue. And I think we've got a two-pronged attack. We would be prepared to appeal to the Environment Court, but we're also making the major thrust with the Select Committee on Local Government and Environmental Issues, of which Nikki Kay is a member, and Sue Kedgley. And Sue Kedgley, the Green MP, has been a really solid supporter. And so we're trying to apply pressure on that committee, to apply pressure on Nick Smith, the Minister of the Environment.
And what would you like him to do?
I'd like him to set up an independent inquiry into the advice that the Interagency Committee gave to the previous government, because one of the things that really upsets us is the biased nature of the constitution of the current Interagency Committee. The only medical person that's on that committee is a Dr. David Black of Auckland, who, when quizzed by Sue Kedgley, admitted that he does a lot of consultancy work for Vodafone and Telecom. So you can't say that he doesn't have a conflict of interest.
And I think that's right across medical research, actually, that a lot of it is provided, or a lot of scientific research is actually done by corporations or funded by corporations. Therefore, the kinds of questions they're asking aren't necessarily the kinds of questions that we need answering in terms of health.
I mean, to go right back to the beginning to how this all started, there was a group setting themselves up in the mid-1990s called ICNIRP, the International Commission for Non-Ionising Radiation Protection. We don't know the exact composition of the committee, but we do know that they got funding from telecommunication companies in Europe. and they reviewed all the literature, and basically the way they've arrived at their guidelines, published in 1998, was that experiments were done on laboratory animals to evaluate the thermal effects, the heating effects of the radiation, so like your microwave oven. And these were acute effects, and no more than short-term. What we're talking about is long-term effects. And the acute effects were things like shocks, burns, stimulation of nerves and muscles. And that's a far cry from chronic exposure to low-dose radiation. And I think the best analogy for your listeners to grasp is that to ultraviolet radiation, to sunlight. I think we all know that if we go out in midsummer and stay out exposed too long, we will get sunburns, and it's painful, and it's obvious we're red. But look at Australia and New Zealand. Here we have a very high UV radiation content because of perhaps the hole in the Antarctic, you know, and we've got the highest incidence of melanoma. So that's the analogy, is that low dose exposure over many years can cause biological effects that ends up in carcinogenesis, ends up in tumour formation, and that's our concern.
So it's a very real concern. It's not just that you want an inquiry to see whether there is an effect, but you feel that there is actually an effect which needs to be investigated more thoroughly.
Yeah.
And other standards, was there something around the standards in New Zealand being different from in Europe as well?
The standards in New Zealand, written in 1999, were based entirely on the ICNIRP guidelines in 1998, which, said, oh yes, there is some epidemiological evidence of cancer, but this is not absolutely convincing, so we're absolutely excluding it, we're rejecting it. So there is data there in the literature that these guys, who I believe have got a conflict of interest because of their ties to the telecommunication industry, are neglecting a lot of the evidence that is in peer-reviewed journals, i.e. it's been independently reviewed by anonymous referees.
Lovely. Okay, well, and what's your, how are you tackling the public? Because obviously I think one of the things is winning the hearts and minds of people who use cell phones all the time, who want increased access to, you know, better communication, want to send photographs over their mobile phones, et cetera, et cetera. So how are you winning the hearts and minds of people?
Well, I mean, we've had a lot of support on the island from when we started last August, from the Gulf News, from the Marketplace, and Waiheke Radio interviewed me, Chris Walker interviewed me, and you've interviewed Andrew Crawford. We did have a petition. We got, in a very short space of time, 680 or thereabouts signatures, which had been tabled in Parliament. The same thing is happening over in Monaco. They're already trying to get the hearts and minds of people. They had this public meeting three Sundays ago where there was 300 people turned out on a Sunday evening, and very well supported. There'd been a previous public meeting that Sue Kedgley gave, and again, that was supported by over 200 people on a very cold winter Sunday night. Now, our greatest frustration is with the print media and the television media. And I am cynical enough to believe that advertising revenue in the print media has been a major problem in getting letters published in the Herald. I think we've written at least 10 letters and had two or three published.
Oh, really?
And yet, you know, you look in the weekend paper or even weekday, you'll see full-page adverts for Vodafone or Telecom's new 3GT.
Go independent media.
Yeah, well, who's the independent media, they said?
Well, you know, the Gulf News, your local newspapers, and Waiheke Radio. I mean,
we
that's
do
where
that.
You get messages
we,
like this out.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about people wanting better communications. I put it to you that this rollout of 3G technology has nothing to do with better communications. It's to do with making your cell phone into a laptop computer. And that's why they need to have these cell phone transmitter stations around about 800 metres apart. They've got to talk to each other. So it's not better audio communication or photographic communication, which you get with your 2G technology. It's this ability to be able to download from the computer. If you were watching Paul Henry's programme during the week when they interviewed a guy from the new 2G company, that's what they're saying. This is what people want to do. They want to be able to sit on the bus and be downloading emails or looking at the web.
And I think that's an interesting comment as well, because I wonder how many people really do want to be sitting on the bus doing that.
But
that's that thing of selling people something that they may or may not want, and then something that they want it.
You know, you're harmless if you're sitting there with an iPod. But you're right. You see, what's happening is that the telcos, being big business, they're leading the consumer. If you remember about 3 years back, Telecom were advertising the rollout of 3G using school kids getting off a bus saying, "We want it now." And that's exactly what they're doing. They're altering the consumer's desire for the new technology, not that the consumers are demanding that.
Well, that's right. That's advertising, isn't it?
Oh, sure.
Anyway, but just last quick point. What about the stuff on Waiheke specifically? So the bowling tower, other networks going up on Waiheke?
As far as the bowling club's concerned, Telecom have withdrawn their application because we made a very strong submission that their submission was in breach of the height regulation. And so after Andrew Crawford appeared before one of the subcommittees at the council, the officers recommended that the submission should be notified, which meant that there would be public hearings. And it strikes me that the last thing that the telecommunications company wants is written and oral submissions from the public and the adverse publicity that could bring.
So that's been a bit of a victory then?
Yeah, it's a bit of a lame victory because we don't know. We got into the game too late to be able to protest against Vodafone. By the time we went to the community board, Vodafone's submission had already been approved. It doesn't seem to have proceeded yet, and maybe they're wary about the emotions that were stirred up.
And I think that's the thing about keeping it in the public eye,
sure.
so that you know, even though they can do it legally, they might not want to because of the adverse publicity they get.
I mean, don't get us wrong, we're not Luddites, we're not against new technology, but we're against the new technology being put down outside people's homes, schools, hospitals, without any input from the public. After all, we're the ratepayers and the taxpayers.
Stuart Rubin, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about the cell phone tower issue.
My pleasure, Shirin.
Paul Harrop, who is the musical director for the Aotea Youth Symphony Orchestra. Hi, Paul.
How are you, Shireen?
Oh, all very well, thanks.
Good.
And so you guys have got a concert on the 22nd at Mora Hall?
We have indeed. It's in aid of the Mora Hall itself.
Oh, okay.
All the funds are going to the Mora Hall Fund.
Oh, right. And what does the Mora Hall Fund want to do?
Well, keep its hall standing, I think. That's the main thing.
So it's going to repairs or...
going to what?
Is it going to repairs of the building?
Yeah, maintenance, I understand, and making sure that it's kept up to scratch.
Right. Okay. And so tell us about who's coming over.
Well, the orchestra is coming over. This is our sixth visit to Waiheke over the years. They are 55 strong, and no doubt will fill Mora Hall without any problem. And they will do the normal repertoire of the last night of the proms, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And with them will be Mary Melville from the island here and Ian Tetley to do some vocals.
Lovely. That sounds like an amazing evening. And how much does it cost to get in?
I'm not sure about that. You'll have to have a look at the poster or something.
Okay, I'll have a look out for it and see if I can find that information for a bit later.
Yeah. In fact, I wouldn't even know where to get a ticket, but there's posters all around the island, and I'm sure that says where to get the tickets. But you have to hurry, because the last report is they're nearly all sold out.
Oh, okay, right, yes. Well, it's quite an amazing event. If you've got 55 people coming over, a whole range of instruments, it'll be a real treat. So tell us a bit about the Youth Symphony.
Well,
who are they?
Well, I started it 22 years ago, and it was at the behest of the Mount Albert Borough Council, as it was then. They wanted to start a music group, and I thought I was getting involved in a little group of about maybe 12 people or something like that. And lo and behold, we just found that we stepped straight into a demand market, and it's never looked back. We now have two orchestras, a junior training orchestra and this main symphony orchestra, and they consist of young people around about 15 to 20 odd, with an average age about halfway through that, about 17. And we play a long, wide repertoire from pop music to the classical repertoire. And it's a demand market. We've never had any trouble recruiting, and some of our people have gone on to the National Orchestra and overseas. Eventually, we've toured extensively through Australia, Europe. We were in Germany last year, Japan, Colorado. And the idea is that it introduces these young people to musical performance, something to aspire to and work towards.
So there's a whole aspect to it, which is building confidence and enabling people to be in the spotlight for a bit.
And we try and find unusual places to perform. We've performed on Waiheke. We've performed on we performed down at Matiatia one time with Dave Paquette, a concert down there. We performed at the Marae, Little Oniroa, a symphony on the sands, it was called. Very appropriately, and we've done one previous last night of the proms at Mora Hall, so we know the ground fairly well there, and that was a sellout too. So I guess that's why this one is
great. And so, who is the audience for this? Is it older people, younger people? Is there much interest from
the
15 to 25 age range in classical music?
Yeah, no, I'd have to say that they're the more mature part of the island. They apparently, I hear on the grapevine that they are arriving in ball gowns and bedecked in all sorts of Britannic costumes, Union Jacks, and goodness knows what. It's a fun night, and if you know the original where it originates from, it goes right back to 1895, when the first last night of the proms was performed after a series of concerts, which was in answer to the perception that England was lacking in good music. In Germany, they had a saying that England was without music at that time. And so Sir Henry Wood was brought on, and he conducted the first 45 performances of proms almost continuously from 1895 to 1944. And in so doing, he promoted English music, and out of that came the likes of Elgar and Vaughan Williams and all the well-known British classical composers. If you go back before that, one has to admit there isn't much to look at in the British repertoire.
So that served as a kind of injection to British music
at
the time,
very much.
Introduced, to encourage
yes,
people to compose.
Introduced the classical repertoire to the British population. Funnily enough, the very first number in the first performance of Last Night of the Proms was Wagner's Rienzi Overture, which raised eyebrows, of course, being a German composer. But that's the way it's gone. In the first half of the last night of the proms is usually a potpourri of various classical music, and then the second half reverts to very Britannic traditional music, such as Jerusalem and Fantasia on Sea Songs, which is the well-known one that ends up in rural Britannia, and of course Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance, which has at the end of it Land of Hope and Glory. And the idea is that, of course, the crowd gets in behind all this, so they've all got the words. Anybody going will be given the words of all those pieces so that they can roar into it and contribute.
Well, that sounds like a great night out.
Yeah. Well, it was last time, and I can't see any reason why it shouldn't be this time.
Lovely. Well, Paul, thanks very much for coming in to talk to us about the Aotea Youth Symphony and the performance at Mora Hall, which is raising funds for Mora Hall on the 22nd of August. What time does it start, do you know?
Well, I understand it's quite an evening, you know. Some people go to concerts and they see the concert as an interval for a drink with music before and after. This one's slightly different because I believe it's going to start with a drink and then have some music, and then there's an interval with during which you can have another drink, and then you're expected to enter into the frolics of the second half of
right.
The last night of the proms.
Oh, well, it sounds like great fun.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Hi, well, I'm here with Harriet Compton now, who's the musical director of Sister Shout. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, Sharon.
So it's great to have you here. So it's a pretty exciting day for you guys.
Yeah, I think this is, probably our 9th or 10th concert on the island. We tend to do one every year. This one's around the theme of a glory box, which, you know, is a sort of collection of your favourite things, I always think of. I know that they're meant to be wedding trousseaus, but who does that anymore?
Ah, okay. How did you choose these favourite things? Is it the guys in Sister Shout or the girls in Sister Shout who've chosen them, or
the songs? I think I probably chose most of them in collaboration with Rosemary Adler, who's who also she does our arranging and everything, and we decided on a list and ran it past the choir, and they're all pretty keen on that, and then they cleverly wove it together into a story that makes it all relevant to the Glory Box concept, and Jackie Ead did most of the writing, and it's really clever.
Ah, so you've got a sort of a narration which strings it all together.
Yeah, we do. We usually do that. We had one around handbags, which I suppose are a sort of miniature Glory Box in themselves, and we've done them about, around water and just various themes, but this one's sort of around how two people get on with each other over the course of their lives and often end up on your own, happier.
Ah, interesting. That would be an unusual concept to promote, but yeah. Now,
it's the new black, I think.
Right. So tell us a bit about Sister Shout for people who might not know.
Actually, I was at Simon Johnson's funeral and I met the guy who started Sister Shout, which is odd that it was a guy, but I think it was about a million years ago, or maybe around 15 or 16 years ago, that they started. And I would have joined when we came to the island in 96. So I've been there for sort of 13 years and I've been directing it for 6 years.
Oh, and have you had much experience in musical direction before then?
No, none whatsoever.
Right. Well, you look quite amazing when you're up there. So what does a musical director of a cappella group do?
Well, you learn the parts, learn the four parts and then teach them and then put it all together. The teaching is not, it's not really my best skill. It's hard to be accurate, and I think one of the things I like about gospel is that as long as you're in harmony, you don't have to be completely accurate. It's not like Handel. you learn the parts, teach them, and then I guess add a bit of swing and a bit of the sister's own sensibilities when it comes to actually performing it.
All right, so that's something that's added afterwards by you or
through the process? Yes, we don't always do things the way that they were originally written. We try to add our own feeling to them. Yeah.
Right, lovely. And is it a fairly constant group of women, or does it change a lot?
Well, there have been there are women there, Linda Johnson and Jackie, and some women in the choir who've been there for much longer than me, Vicky, Jane, and then there are women who've been there a year. So over the years, you know, people come and go, your life changes and you get interested in other things, or you suddenly decide that it's time to join a choir, and so, yeah, all different lengths of time.
Lovely. And what are your preferences in a cappella? What kinds of things do you love?
Well, I definitely prefer gospel. You know, there's just something about the way in which gospel developed, and I guess the enormous faith surrounding it. To me, it doesn't really matter what faith that is, but it brings a power to the music that would not be there otherwise. I think I said in the Weekender, you know, I don't find that same sort of power in madrigals or barbershop. It just doesn't have the impact. I love gospel music, and also obviously it's got the ability to change. You know, it doesn't have to be exactly as it was written, and most of it never was written down, so a lot of it was learnt by ear, which suits my way of learning because I don't read music.
And now we've got Martini talking to us about the occupation of the fishing trawler in Auckland Harbour. Hi, Martini. How are you doing?
How are you? I'm doing very well. It's a great day, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lovely day.
Hey?
Great day to be out on a fishing trawler.
Yes. It's then it's quite enjoyable. Yeah, yesterday the Greenpeace activist, they blockaded a New Zealand fishing vessel, the Seamount Explorer. And they were sitting in little life rafts and connected the action with Foot Town. And the reason why Foot Town is in the picture is Greenpeace has started for a while now a campaign to put pressure on supermarkets to buy sustainable fish. And with sustainable fish, we mostly mean fish which is not being overfished, which is threatened to become extinct, but also fish which is caught by sustainable methods. And this particular vessel, the Seamount Explorer, it goes out every year around this time from July onwards. And it visits seamounts in the Tasman Sea, and they fish for orange roughy. Now, orange roughy is a fish which grows very, very, very slowly, and it doesn't reproduce till they're about 30 years old. So these are fish, A, they are threatened, but B, fishing on seamounts means it's bottom trawling, and basically what they do is destroy the whole sea floor. And they, besides the orange roughy, they also haul up very ancient cold water coral reefs. Some are like trees. They're meter high. They take hundreds of years to grow, and we call that a very destructive fisheries. And it's time that the supermarkets, which play a very big role in the fishing industry as big buyers of fish. It's their responsibility today in 2009 that they buy these fish from good sources, that they know that particular fish is not overfished, is not threatened, that particular fish is not associated with very destructive fishing methods, and that was what this action is all about.
So is this a new campaign, this idea of going for these supermarkets and asking them to adopt some responsibility? Because I don't remember it being phrased in quite this way. I do know a lot of people talking about dolphins and bottom trawling and all of this stuff, but to actually say to the supermarkets, you have some responsibility here and we are specifically targeting you to look at how you obtained your fish. Is there a difference there?
That is that campaign has been going on for a while now. It was started about 2 years ago by Greenpeace UK, where they did research into the major supermarkets and give them basically points for good and bad behavior. And we published publicly the results of these surveys, whether these supermarkets have a sustainable policy, that for starters, and I could tell you right now, Woolies here on Waiheke doesn't. Its parent company, it doesn't. They don't have a sustainable fish policy. They continue to have endangered species like orange roughy in their shelves, while right now UK supermarkets, they have taken the New Zealand orange roughy and the New Zealand hake and hoki from their shelves because the hoki fisheries is in a similar situation where the numbers go down in such rapid in a rapid way, plus their bycatch of birds and other marine life is incredible, and we call that unsustainable. So while in the UK we have the campaign going for about 2 years now, and the end result is they're taking off New Zealand caught fish off their shelves for the right reasons, and New Zealand has to follow suit. And this is the beginning of this type of campaign in this area, both in New Zealand and in Australia. And we published the red fish list, which is basically a guide to fish which are not really kosher to consume. And so it's a guide to consumers, but it's also a guide to supermarkets. Because some fish is okay in some area, but it's not okay in another area. So hence, it's very important to know exactly where it's coming from. It's important to know by who it is caught. Greenpeace maintains a blacklist of illegal fishing vessels on the web with companies.
Oh, so that's interesting.
Names.
So you could actually be buying a fish that has been fished sustainably, or you could be buying that same fish which has been fished unsustainably. Is that right?
It varies over the planet. In some areas, some ocean areas, the situation is worse for a particular species than in another. But it has become critical given the state of fisheries overall. 75% of all the stocks are either overfished, overexploited, and etc., etc. New Zealand is in a reasonable state, but let's say the warning signs are all there. We had this documentary this week on New Zealand television about the great New Zealand fishing scandal, and I don't know if you've seen it, but
no, tell us about that.
Yeah, that it demonstrated really that the biggest threat to the fishing industry is the large industrial fishing. here on Waiheke, we have people who go out in a little boat and catch their fish, and that's all kosher. There's a recreational fisheries which need to be monitored, but it's in particularly the big industrial fleets which really need to be monitored. What became clear is that under the New Zealand system, the quotas are being caught by overseas vessels, primarily Russian big trawlers. These trawlers are not only catching their quota of sometimes unsustainable fish in sometimes unsustainable fisheries, but they also catch an enormous amount of other fish. Their bycatch is incredible, and there was an example of a New Zealand fisherman. He was fishing next to this big Russian trawler here in New Zealand waters, and he was fishing for a specific species, and he got some, and then it. When the fishing reports or catch reports were published, there was none of these fish appeared in the catch by these foreign trawlers, which means these foreign trawlers take a hell of a lot more fish than basically reported, and they threaten the livelihood of smaller scale New Zealand fisheries. 2.5 in a year's time, in a couple of years' time, the number of small New Zealand fishing operators declined from 2,500 to about 1,200. This is half.
Is that in the last couple of years?
That's right. And, you know, the New Zealand fisherman is pushed out of its own waters by big companies like Sea Lord operating these Russian trawlers, which the people on board, A, work under slave-type conditions. They get paid bugger all, way too little, really. It is slave labor. They don't pay any taxes in New Zealand. None of the money stays in New Zealand, and they calculated that the New Zealand industry is deprived of some $3 billion by this practice. And
so why are the New Zealand fishermen forced out? Is it a question that the others are selling their fish more cheaply, or...
They have to buy their quota. Everybody has to buy, and they have, in a sense, they have much more operational cost. For example, there is an observer system here in New Zealand, but none of the observers is willing to go on these Russian trawlers. So, A, we don't know exactly.
Why not? Is it dangerous or something?
It's, well, you're on a big boat, and usually they're not very well maintained. You know, it's rust buckets basically, with 80 foreigners on board who don't really want anybody to look over their shoulder to see exactly what they are doing. As a consequence, observers are treated like, well, basically, let's call it crudely, like shit, and they are given the worst cabins. And this is 24-hour operation. If there's only one person, can't cover everything. While the New Zealand fishermen, they have to take their observers on board, and it's the fishing people who have to pay for it. So it's added cost, operational cost to the fishermen, which. You know, operational cost and catches and prices are all related. If your operation costs go up too much, then you can't maintain it anymore.
So, Martini, can you explain to me what sustainable fishing is? Because when I look at the statistics on fishing, I just think I shouldn't eat any fish at all. Or if a friend of mine goes out on a little boat and catches some fish, then I eat it. What does sustainable fishing mean? Where do we get our fish? How can we eat it so that it is sustainable?
I would describe sustainable fisheries as a fisheries which takes the amount it takes doesn't threaten the stocks overall. We are not against fishing, absolutely not. but it has to be sustainable. You can't catch too much. You can't catch too many smaller species. You have to make absolutely sure that that particular fish stock is not threatened. We know reasonably well how many fish can be caught of that stock without threatening the species. And it's also sustainable fisheries is also, again, the way you catch. Bottom trawling is highly, highly destructive. Mid trawling, if you have a lot of bycatch of seals and birds, then it's destructive. It's doesn't help anybody.
And so how can we know? I mean, are you suggesting that we don't buy any, is part of the campaign not buying any fish from the supermarket, or what does the campaign want to do?
What you yourself can do is go to the Greenpeace New Zealand website and print out a copy of the Red Guide, which it tells you about all the species and how it's related, what methods are used to fish. The guide will give you a good overview of what's kosher and what is not. So it's all about basically informing yourself with the information which is available and then make your decision yourself. The campaign is as a guide to the consumer, but also a pressure on the supermarket. It's their responsibility that they put sustainable food on their shelves, and it's simply their responsibility. The supermarkets have to have a policy, a clear policy, that this is what they want to achieve. And so the campaign is not against consumers. You don't have to feel, you know, absolutely, totally guilty. Oh no, I better not tell Greenpeace I eat these fish. You know, Jesus, they come out. There's too many of them on the island. You know, dangerous. Nah, it's. But we hope that the consumer will join Greenpeace in this campaign to put pressure on the supermarkets, and that's what they definitely can do. You can do, if you go to Woolies this afternoon, there's probably a good chance that there is orange roffee available in Woolies. You can ask, hey, where's the manager here? How come? Ask questions. Open your mouth. Write a letter. These are all things people can do to up the pressure on the supermarkets, and that in the end, it's their responsibility to put kosher fish on their shelves.
Mm. So this campaign has been run quite successfully in England, and now it's coming here.
Not only in England, there's other countries in Europe as well, Netherlands, Austria, even France is seeing the light with, for example, the bluefin tuna in the Mediterranean, which is a highly, highly threatened species. And there is rampant illegal fishing going on, including by French seiners in this instance. But a couple of weeks ago, Sarkozy announced that the bluefin tuna should go on the CITES list, which is the international list of threatened species, and you shouldn't go after the bluefin tuna at all. And this is what the consumer can do. The consumer, with organizations like Greenpeace, there's other organizations as well, do the same thing, put the pressure on if the supermarkets don't buy this stuff anymore, it will go. It's simply, that's the way it works. If they can't sell it, they don't catch it.
So, that was Martini talking about fishing. And if you want fish and chips in the next 20 years, you're going to have to get on to the business of telling your supermarket that they shouldn't be bottom trawling and fishing fish with a half-life of 15 years.
You've been listening to interviews from Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you by Island Designs every Saturday morning from 10 till 12. The interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7pm and Island Life can be downloaded as a podcast from our website www.waihekiradio.org.nz.